forum, and we hope you enjoy the talk.
Thank you.
Hello, can you hear me? Yeah. So I'd like, first of all, to thank all the organizers for inviting me here. That's very kind. And so I'm Edward Ando. I'm someone who's been circulating, orbiting around this Cortex group who I'd like to talk to you about later. And I'm here to tell you about knowledge and the scientific method, right? To talk about intellectual self-defense and skepticism. Okay, so these are topics which very much talk about science, but not actually science in themselves. So I'd like, first of all, to thank Richard Monvoisin, who's helped prepare this presentation. And I'd like to introduce myself. So I'm a CNRS research engineer working in material science. I'm a mechanical engineer. And as such, I'm also a visiting scientist at the Institut Laure Langevin. And I'm working with some engineering companies in France, such as Total, EDF, Lafarge, and Saint-Gobain. I think it's really important to tell you, and the rest of Cortex don't have any industrial affiliations at all. And I think when I'm going to try to give you these rather fundamental talks about what is knowledge, how can we make mistakes, can you be influenced, we really take it to heart to tell you who we're paid by, where do we come from, in order to be able to color and to understand better what we're saying. So I do experiments, I build machines, I make measurements, but this is not the topic of today. So today I would like to do something completely different, which I'm very proud to be talking to you about today. So I'd like to give you an introduction of what science is. You're all PhD students, or it's a PhD student's day at least. You're working in the topic of science, I hope there's no doubts about that. However, actually pinning down what science is a little bit more subtle, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about this rather funny and controversial subject of intellectual self-defense, and then we will conclude about talking about critical thinking in general and specifically in Grenoble. So the world is getting complicated, and knowing how to judge information is getting pretty difficult. So fake news has been very much in the news recently. There have been presidential discussions. I don't know if you followed the Senate hearings of certain Alabama senators last night. There's some very interesting things happening where reality is difficult to understand what is really there. There's been hacking, which kind of leads us to the conclusion that information can be manipulated, there can be conflicts of interest, and it's difficult to know what weights to apply, right? You may have heard this rather catchy notion of the post-truth society, right? Where truth no longer is important. So inside all this mess of information and different things that can be inside people's heads, we'd like to try to define all these ideas of what is a fact, what is an opinion, when somebody makes a statement, when somebody holds a belief, when there is knowledge about something. You can spend a lot of time, there are always a lot of exceptions, and so I'd like to start by making a clear cut between two different things. One thing, which is choosing between these two as a human being, as a rational person, is just a choice, right? There's no moral or value judgment behind it. We can either choose to believe something as an act of faith, so with no need of proof and no need of counterproof, or we can allow ourselves to be convinced, we can choose to be convinced by the evidence and our logical reasoning, in which case the proof becomes and the evidence becomes very important, right? Hope you agree this is not a controversial split, right? It's just we either choose to believe something or we choose to go with evidence and proof. Another important split, which again has no judgment at all behind it, is between non-science, which is not to be confused with nonsense, right? Non-science is a wonderful thing. There is art, which can make you feel things. There can be looking inside oneself. There can be faith, spirituality, literature, things that are valuable, passionate, exciting, but of which are fundamentally subjective, right? So it's possible to debate about things, it's possible to debate the merits of Italian versus French literature, but I hope you share my feeling that it would be a little bit crazy to be able to get to a conclusion whether French or Italian literature is better, right? We just don't have this level of objectivity. Science, on the other hand, tries to be as objective as possible. And so, well, science, I've said it a few times now, let's try to drill down onto what science means, because in some people's heads, I think not in this audience, but in other audiences, science is, does not have the nice feeling of warmth that we have when we talk about science. So one way, I'm happy some people recognize this, when people talk about science, they can talk sometimes about scientists. In science, you need to publish a certain amount of papers. This is really talking about the people who do science. This is not the definition that interests me. This is, you know, I wanted to make a stack of books, but it's so ugly. So another way to talk about science is the sum of all scientific knowledge, right? Science says that Wikipedia is not a good representation of the sum of all human knowledge, but it's not a bad one either. This is not the definition that interests me as well. And of course, the getting a consensus of all of the scientific knowledge, as you can imagine, can be quite controversial. Yeah, that's left. The thing that can really make people very, very angry is this idea of technopolitics. We're sitting in a building in Site Ampère of NCMAG or whatever, of Grenoble IMP. This building has been built by someone, and it wasn't a professeur and directeur de recherche who built this building, right? This money came from somewhere. And the decision about where to put money can cause controversy and stress. They know there are all these unethical testing of things, or there can be medical scandals. There's the technopolitical, related to money and power, way of doing things. I don't know if you can read this slide, but okay, there's some scientist with dollars in his eyes saying, I'll do whatever science you want if you give me the money so that I can build a building like this. But there's a meaning which is much more nice and which is much more inclusive, which is this meaning. That science is a binding intellectual endeavor. So from this point of view, we'd like to say, we'd like to define science as a thing with rules. So we're bound to follow these rules. We'll talk about the rules in a second. We're using our brain and rationality to try to understand things, right? And we try to make assertions, statements, theories. We try to describe the world. And we try to do it in a way that they are testable, that they are plausible and in correspondence with reality, and as objective as possible. This, again, I hope is not a controversial definition, but it is not everyone is totally in agreement with this. So this definition keeps together all types of sciences. So there are people who talk about basic fundamental physics, there is social sciences, there's a lot of things in between, with rather unnecessary arguments, in my opinion. If we just say that we are, that science follows this kind of method, we have a nice, if you want to, if you like, philosophical terms, there's this idea of methodological monism, so without a split. We keep this together with a common method. But more than a common method, there's also a kind of agreement about the fundamental rules, right? So I'm not talking about maths, I'm talking about science and observation of the world. So I'm not going to talk about axioms, which can be very controversial. I'm going to talk about science. Science is trying to describe reality, and in order to do that, we have to agree together that reality exists, right? That's not the most controversial thing in the world, but we have to say that we're not in the Matrix, for example. But even then, what if we were in the Matrix? We can just say, well, we're in the Matrix, I can still try to find out how it works. Or even more simply, well, I'll just call reality, well, I'll just call the Matrix reality, and then I can just keep going with my science, right? It does not depend on us. A nice example is that the moon does not disappear when we can't see it anymore, right? It's still there. That's probably quite a good idea. And we can access it by thinking and reasoning logically. Another important point is this idea of materialism. So I'm trying to avoid as many isms as possible because we soon get into philosophical debates and a lot of terms which need to be defined. Materialism, however, is very important. Materialism is this idea that reality contains everything. Reality is everything. There are no supernatural entities, right? The plane of supernatural entities, as a person, you're allowed to believe it or not. Again, it's a matter of choice. I'm not here to tell you how to think. However, as a scientist, you must work on the assumption that there is only reality there, right? It's not allowed to bring in any supernatural entities to explain what's going on. So let's drill down into that a little bit further again. And I hope you... This is rather uncontroversial stuff, right? When you see things like reality exists, okay, fine. Young scientists here, I'd like to tell you that any unproven supernatural entity introduces a weakness into the whole system. So you might recognize this young ancient Greek lady here, Pandora, who's opening the box of, of all the problems in the world. Right, this is not a very good analogy, it's used by a number of people, but if you imagine that inside the box is contained a nice web of science where a whole load of observations and knowledge are built up one on the other, well, the moment we let one of these bad supernatural entities in, and here I'm giving myself a value judgment of bad because it introduces an unexplained, untestable thing on which then, if other things are built, the whole system becomes unstable. So this is very, very dangerous, right? Again, let me repeat that you're allowed as a human being to choose whatever you want. When we're doing science, however, it's very important not to. It's essential, essentially. Of course, things can exist. I think we're certainly in front of an audience who does signal processing and measurements. There are many things that we cannot detect directly, right? That doesn't mean they're supernatural. That means that we don't have the senses in order to detect them. That doesn't mean they're not there. They're not above nature. This brings us back nicely to the idea of testability. So let's drill down into testability a bit. So if you've lived in France for a few years and if you have a postbox, I'm sure somebody has slipped one of these into your postbox, but I had to find an example in English. There's a wonderful website which contains every single one of these ever handed out, right? So they encourage people to take photos and upload them. It's rather wonderful. So a scientific assertion must be testable. Are these testable assertions? So do they survive the test? Can we call them a scientific assertion? Well, so some of them no. So the fact that Keanu can tell the past is not a testable assertion. But the fact that he can tell the present or the future is indeed testable, right? So from that point of view, we could consider it to be a scientific assertion. We get into some pretty complicated concepts later on, but reunited the separate, reunites the separated, could be tested in principle, right? Now, I'm saying it could be tested. Of course, there's a whole range of validity of claims, right? Anyone can make a scientific-looking assertion, and then as scientists, we can spend our time to try to understand whether that accurately represents reality or not, right? So we can have some a priori feeling about what Keanu's statement is. However, we can't do anything until we test it, right? So this is a very good, and I'll get back to that point in a second. So we can find out that in every case, Keanu makes a complete mistake, right? And so we can just say that from a testability point of view, it's false, or mostly false, or mostly plausible. Or in the case of very good fundamental theories, which is probably not Keanu's case, we can say that they are verified so far. The best anything can be is verified so far. Right? So let's go back to this idea of we are not in the world of mathematics where we're making deductions one after the other. We are still trying to describe the world, and it's quite possible that in discovering it, we might, something that has been verified so far will turn out to be false, right? This is the famous Hume's problem of induction, if you like philosophical terms. Some people say that he famously wrote that I have observed all swans to be white. I think, don't quote me on this, right? But I have observed all swans to be white, and so I assume all swans are white. Until, some years later, somebody went to Australia and found a black swan, and so something that was verified so far turned out to be false. And this is the case of all theories, right? They are only right until they're proven to be wrong. And so quite a smart Austrian tried to take this idea even further and came up with this principle of refutability. This is Karl Popper in quite a nice photo. Karl Popper, so this is one of the important tools that I would like to hand over to you, is this idea of refutability. So Karl Popper says to select a scientific theory, so somebody says, I have this theory, and you, in your mind, you can say, well, is it refutable or not? In English, we use falsifiable, but in French, I think falsifiable means fake copies of passports or something. And so they talk more about refutability. Any scientific theory must come with a way in which can be falsified, okay? So if I tell you, if I make a general statement about Maxwell's equations, about gravitation, it should be accompanied with, if you can prove this fact here, then I will have to admit that my theory is false. Now, in philosophy, there's a certain amount of controversy as to whether scientists, you guys, actually operate like this day to day. Are you constantly generating theories and trying to falsify them? It's an interesting debate, but it's not the point I'm trying to prove. I hope we agree that it's very important that after the theory is generated, that it comes with this key to be able to unlock it. Otherwise, you can build up crazy things that are can never be refuted. So this is a very important criterion, and it's a very nice way to see if something is scientific or not. So let's talk about generating theories, right? Another way when you are collecting data, doing statistics, and then trying to describe the world using your measurement tools, there's another very important principle, which is another idea I'd like you to keep, is this Occam's razor. So Occam's razor wants to cut off unnecessary hypotheses, okay? So it's this principle of sparsity. So when I've collected data which seems to show something, I can describe it bringing in a whole load of different ideas, or I can try to describe it with very few ideas. And the idea here is that not only is it the number of ideas which is important, it's also the kind of weight of these ideas. So I could say that in electrostatic theory, we depend on charges and distances and the transmittivity of the space. Or I could say there's just invisible leprechauns who move around particles, and that's why we feel a force. So in one case there is one, and in one case there is three, but I hope you agree that the weight of the three simple explicative ideas is it's less heavy from this point of view than the one rather unbelievable idea. So this is a very important way to be able, if I have two theories explaining the same data, we generally or always follow the one which has the least amount of weight in order to explain this data. It's often used, we can use it to separate, it's often used in the development of theory. You've collected data, you want to try to explain it. I guess as smart people you are, I guess you're normally attracted by the most simple sort of explanation, right? It's the easiest one, you have to write a shorter PhD, everyone's happy, nice publications, it's great. So I've given you a number of different tools, and I'd like to try to use these tools now to separate a theory from a scenario. Now, it's difficult to choose a non-controversial example, but I'd like to compare, for example, what I consider to be the theory of evolution compared to the scenario I consider to be a scenario of intelligent design, right? Now, in the case of the theory of evolution, there is no act of faith necessary, right? We just try to go with the data, what we see in geological strata, what we see looking at the well-separated islands. There seem to be few subjective beliefs associated with this theory, and if we use Occam's razor to try to, I hope you understand what the idea behind evolution is, I won't go into it. From the point of view of Occam's razor, there are few entities involved. There's a notion of time, a notion of changing, of mutation, and there's a notion of successive reproduction. So from that point of view, there are few entities, and they're highly explicative. And from the point of view of Popper, this was actually quite an interesting example, because Popper, initially, when he wrote his famous book, said, I think evolution is actually not falsifiable. But in a very interesting debate, he then changed his mind and said, well, in fact, if in the Precambrian strata underground we find the corpse of a rabbit, yeah, that would probably falsify evolution. And from an intellectual point of view, the theory is able to be humble, to change, to recognize mistakes. Intelligent design, and this is a very key point, starts from an act of faith, right? So starting from an act of faith about the existence and the desires of God, which again, there is no judgment behind, but it starts from there and builds a theory to explain something. The subjective beliefs are built into this theory, and from a point of view of Occam's razor, it's a very heavy point of view. It's not falsifiable. Generally, there is no keys to unlock this scenario, and it is quite far away from evidence. So, one last tool I would like to hand you with. So, here are not. It's kind of. I'd like to show you that with these simple tools I've given you, you can actually drill down and in such a debate, try to. You don't need to force other people to change their mind. You need to try to understand things. You can try to understand which one is scientific and which one is not, right? To differentiate a theory which is generally applicable to a scenario which is designed to explain a simple thing. One more thing, the burden of proof. So this idea is that the burden of proof is on the person who makes the claim, right? So I say, I think something is true. Now, If I say I think something is true and it's not very controversial, I don't need to give you a lot of proof. So Richard famously uses the example of, I saw a frog. That is a statement. It's not very far away from reality, and I don't need to give you much proof, hopefully, to convince you that that is the case. If you say, I saw a frog that was one ton frog, you're going to have to justify that to me, right? And if I say, I saw a one-ton invisible frog talking French, that's going to need a lot of justification, right? More generally, so Hume wrote this, Hume's maxim, to do with miracles, but miracles can just be considered to be any extraordinary event. He says, and this is a very nice way to think about it, no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle, so no proof, no evidence is sufficient to establish a miracle, unless the testimony, the proof, the person we're interrogating, would be of such a kind that the fact of it being false would be even more miraculous than the thing that's being stated. Hume, I think, believed in miracles, right? But he was thinking very rationally about how we could be sure or not of their existence. Okay, so I'd like to now just talk to you rapidly, how am I doing in terms of time? I think I'm doing okay. About all these now technical philosophical terms in which I've been asked you to talk to you about. So we have these ideas of skepticism, from skeptome, to doubt, to seek, in fact, in Greek. This idea of critical thinking, or this very French idea of zététique, it's got two accents, so it's got to be French, which are all sort of positions, intellectual dispositions about the world. So skepticism is actually philosophically a little bit dangerous, because there are people who are skeptical, for example, about the existence of knowledge. Some people say, I don't think knowledge could ever exist. Okay, well, okay, that's not, we're talking more about rational skepticism, right? Which is more to do with having a culture of doubt, of reasonable and rational doubt. And I think some of the tools I presented here are really the sort of minimum toolbox to be able to go out and have a skeptical point of view on the world, right? Perhaps, I hope, many of you have doubt when you're doing your own science, when you're confronted with new ideas in the world. But these tools really help to drill in and to vector your doubt and try to understand whether things are true or not. Because at the end of the day, this is not nasty stuff. The idea is behind there is a very honest desire to try to understand reality. Yeah? And so there's one last point I'd like to make, which is in this desire to understand reality, we've understood about different theories, we've understood about the simplicity with Occam's razor, about falsifiability, about different claims. There's one more key area where errors can come from, where we can make mistakes, even as very nice and good, honest PhD students and professors and all this stuff, which is us. Right? We make a lot of mistakes. To do with bias, right? So at the beginning of this speech, I told you that I'm working with these big companies, which have been accused, and I think quite rightly, of doing some pretty nasty stuff in history. Getting hot. But I think it's important for me to tell you that, because if I'm trying to convince you of something related to how nice Total is, the fact that that my recent neutron imaging instrument has been in part paid by them is an important fact, right? That should color the data that I'm giving you, and we wish and we really hope and work in the idea that this should be systematically the case. Right, when I'm talking to you about particle physics, whether or not I'm paid by it's not so important. But on more controversial subjects, the point of view of the person is super important. You can be very proud to be living in France, where since some years there's now a website where you can go and type in every doctor in France. This is now a legal requirement, and you can see who they've been paid by and what gifts have been given to them by the different companies. This auditability allows you to then understand whether there is any bias in the medical, the medicine they're prescribing to you, right? This is super important. If I'm giving you a course about rock mechanics and oil reservoir and climate change, maybe the person funding me, I will not talk about any recent historical events, but you can imagine what I'm thinking, is kind of important, right? There's another important potential source of bias. The person who's doing the science can also introduce, even trying to work in the best scenario of simple hypotheses, of refutability, of honesty, There can be very many different sources of bias. There are many different kinds that we try to study in detail, but confirmation bias is really an important one. So for example, in your PhD work, you can try to be proving something is the case. That can lead to a very strong confirmation bias. You should be trying to prove that it's not the case, right? Or you can be designing experiments that in fact only really have one result. It's a very slippery subject. It's difficult sometimes to identify whether there is confirmation bias or not. Some people in the field of medicine have these very strong protocols about double-blind testing to try to avoid confirmation bias. Even in the analysis of your data, you might just throw away a very faraway point. Be careful. One last tool, because I have two more minutes. I assume I have two more minutes. Is this one that I find myself using a lot personally, which is the aliens or your cousin from Sicily or some very external point of view on the problem. When we're doing something strange, when we believe something and it causes us to make an action, it's always nice to think back about if there was a rational alien with a good knowledge of the laws of physics and we were going to vote, which I believe in strongly, but or going to shop or... It's always nice to think, how would I explain this action to a rational but completely empty of information being, right? And I think it's quite a useful tool to understand, are we doing something that has room for some, for example, supernatural ideas or some bad thinking? Okay, I'd like to finish with just telling you that you are in Grenoble, not a very controversial piece of information, and in Grenoble there's this wonderful group called the Collectif de Recherche Transdisciplinaire, bloody French, Esprit Critique and Sciences, and Science, Cortex for short, who has a nice website which is regularly maintained. There's a lot of nice work on that related to critical thinking, related to exposing hoaxes or supernatural beliefs or trying to bring proofs. And even more than that, on the 3rd of October, there will be a Structure Fédérative de Recherche, SFR, on critical thinking, which will open on campus, which will be part of UGA, right? And so this is the first structure, we think, in France dedicated to critical thinking research, and depending on your definitions, also in Europe and in the world, right? So there's a specific research group dedicated to that. So that's really something exciting. And of course, the people in Cortex who meet in the library are always open to questions and to get further on this. So, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Remember all these nice things I've told you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. That's a great question. Thank you for that. The reason you're asking me the question is because the answer is no, right?
Yeah.
The answer is no, but what's really important, I didn't mention it in my slides, but what's really important is the world is not black and white, and you don't need to say, I believe in it or I believe it not in it. You can just suspend your judgment. You can say, I've received this information, it came from this new source, but remember to flag it in some way as, I'm not sure about it. I think that's the key. And then if you want to make a life decision based on that information, come back and try to make sure whether it's true or not. It's not reasonable to try to verify everything.
Yeah.
It's kind of the job of the journalist, but the journalist gets his information. It's very difficult to start the loop somewhere. But this is the thing. I think it's the principle of doubt. You're just saying, am I sure? Does that answer the question?
Yep.
Okay.
classrooms and thinking and you know, things like Renaissance and all this so.
They would if they could, I mean.
No, it kind of brought back such memories for me and to see an initiative like this, you know, I think it's pretty encouraging. But again, my question now is, you talked about testability and all these things. I'm not sure if I'm using the right word.
Yeah.
But how would you, is there a metric or possibility to measure your capacity to do creativity?
That's a wonderful question. I wouldn't want to cite an article I just read because I can't even remember where I read it from. I think that you could construct some scenarios. I think that there have been, I'm not sure, but I think there have been some psychological studies of how much people believe something based on very impartial data. You know, this is kind of in the interest of advertising companies to give you just a slight suggestion and for you to say, oh yeah, okay, I'm pretty sure about that, I'll buy this product. And people's susceptibility to that kind of not certain information is part of critical thinking. But it's such a huge subject and it can cover so many different kinds of information that it's difficult. I think another interesting question is, I can give you some tools, I can talk to you about how to recognize something, but can I really convince someone to become a doubtful person in their life? How built in is it? It's an open question and one that interests me. I don't know if that answers your question really.
I was not expecting to answer, to be honest, because it is difficult to be, but I just wanted to have this.
But I think there's always a distinction between the nihilist who believes in nothing and the person who's credulous who believes in everything. And the nihilist doesn't know whether the piece of bread will nourish him. Maybe you do a bit better than that. But yeah, believing everything can be dangerous. And since things contradict each other, difficult situation.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we have one question.
Hi. You said about the bias, own bias.
Yeah.
In doing your work, and I was a bit curious about that because when you start your PhD, you believe in that idea and you start working on that. So from the initial point, also you are not the neutral, and when you start working more and more, you become more and more towards inclined towards that idea. So you tend to lose your neutrality. Then how you suggest that okay, you have to do it because at the end you cannot, because you know that's one motivation also to work more on that idea and solve the problem, to go around the problem and use different techniques to find the solution. So that bias keeps you going, and if you say that oh I'm neutral, you know then okay at the very conclusion you find the first problem and they say it's not working, you know, and the other thing is more better than this one. How you want to keep the neutral?
I knew I shouldn't have written that slide. So I feel naturally a bit worried when you say that it's not neutral, but I can also understand the point of view that you're being asked to solve this problem and you need to stick with it. I think you've asked me a question that I can't reply without getting into trouble, right? But neutrality, I mean, you should always be thinking, will there be a piece of evidence or a proof that will make me abandon this theory, right? Okay, which will cause some very difficult meetings with my supervisor, of course, but if it doesn't fit the facts, then why are you working on it? However, you can, I think, justify the suspension of your critical thinking while you are working on something, but then I think it would be a very big mistake to then try to publish it and write an introduction or a literature review which is not wrong, or which avoids some evidence, or which forgets some certain fields, right? When we're communicating, when we're developing a theory, there are always some gray zones where you have to say, well, okay, I'll release this assumption for the moment and I'll work forwards and see where I get, okay? That's where whether the refutability idea with Popper actually works in the creation, I'm not sure. But when you've got the final product which tries to explain the world, it must be faced with all of the evidence. Does that satisfy your...
You have to try for that always, but you know, I always find this dilemma that, okay, where we are going,
yeah.
If it is really what makes sense or not, because every theory has some assumptions around that, and that goes away, then your theory goes.
But assumptions are fine, right? Because you're describing, I'm going to describe the world with these limitations, and within these limitations, this description is correct. Newton's laws of gravitation are a great example of that, right? Which they work on some scales and on some other scales, or with some other parameters, they don't work, right? Or Newton's laws in general, if you want. That is fine, but to make an over-general statement which is wrong by ignoring evidence, I really wouldn't suggest to you to do that. That's why the review process and all this stuff exists. But yeah, it's a difficult answer.
So can I just say, is it possible to say in science there is no absolute truth?
Yeah, so the notion of truth, I haven't used truth once in my presentation, and I wanted to write it 30 times, right? Truth is a very dangerous idea. I think the best, ooh, I missed it, that colorful one. This is not truth, right? Let me give you the one I wanted to. I think the best we can do about truth is plausible and in correspondence with reality. Truths exist in maths and in logical deductions, but for example, all swans are white sounded like a truth until it turned out not to be true. So yeah.
So reality has to do with a measure of certainty.
Sorry?
How certain.
Exactly. How many times have we tried to falsify this idea, and how many times have we failed to, gives us an idea about how strong this idea is. But there is never a final truth. And all the people working on particle physics, these fields have changed a lot. And thankfully, people had the brain and the spirit to say, no, it doesn't work, I'm going to change.
My question would be, what ways could we or you or anybody reach this way of thinking to the in society in its entirety?
That's a great question. Because I hope you feel like I do that in teaching this, we make people stronger against fake news and all this. In Grenoble, the Cortex guys do a number of for the moment in French, of doctoral schools, doctoral formation that you can follow, so that's a good start. And there are a number of open to the public lectures. And since, I think, 2 years in the French school curriculum, critical thinking at least appears as a word. Now, how you teach that to 12 to 13-year-olds, I think maybe even putting them inside scenarios where they can be exposed to bias and try to then reason about it is a good idea. But yeah, it's important and it's really not easy. Yeah, I'm sorry, these questions are so lame. These answers are so lame. The questions are great.
Okay, I think at this point we're going to take more questions. Please, if you have any questions, you can see them after the session. I'm available to answer your questions. Once again, I say thank you to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Next in the agenda.